Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Collins Show. My name is Kathleen Sabo. In the wake of the verdict in the George Zimmerman trial in Florida, the door has opened for a continuation of a national dialogue about race, how we think about it and how we don't think about it. Today we'll be talking about how race consciously and unconsciously affects our behavior and the choices we make. Joining me in the studio to discuss these issues are Susanna Rinderly, diversity and inclusion professional and president of Susanna Rinderly Consulting, University of New Mexico professor of language literacy and sociocultural studies at the College of Education, Ricky Lee Allen, and Tanya Covington, executive director of Peacemakers Consulting. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Joining us later by phone will be Catherine McGill, the founder and director of the New Mexico Black History Organizing Committee and the director of Roots Summer Academy, a multicultural arts camp. If you would like to join in our discussion today, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to collinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Collins Show webpage at kunm.org. You may call our local number, 277-5866, that's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Tanya Covington, you've been doing anti-racism work for over 25 years, holding workshops and conversations. When we spoke yesterday in preparation for the show, I confided in you that while I was excited to be continuing our national conversation on KUNM, I was also nervous, concerned about unintentionally saying something incendiary or just stupid even. And I'd love for you to restate how you responded to me, because I think it sets a foundation for our discussion on the air here today.
Well, one of the things I said that one of the things that I do always when I do my conduct my workshops or start conversations is to let people know that, first of all, there aren't any right or wrong answers. Everyone has an opinion, and they're different. And then in order for us to have a conversation where people feel respected and to be able to talk about issues which, frankly, are difficult to talk about because we don't talk about them in this country, and so we don't learn how to talk about them, is that we need to let people know that there shouldn't be any shame, blame, or guilt associated with having the conversation. You should be allowed to say what you think and feel. But also by the same token, be able to listen to what other people think and feel so that we have a respectful conversation and so that nobody can feel bad.
And we actually had a heated conversation, not heated in a bad way, but just energetic conversation before we got on air here today. And my guess is that listening may be the most important part of that conversation.
Absolutely.
So when I announced via social media that we would be exploring the topic of how race affects our choices and behaviors, I was somewhat gently taken to task by a thoughtful, well-meaning friend for perpetuating a discussion involving the word race, not attached to anything other than the human race. And I was reminded that the use of the word race, or separating out people by races, at least in some viewpoints, was an 18th century construct mostly used in connection with the American slave trade. Now, we've already had discussion about that, but Professor Allen, Ricky, when we use the term race, are we already letting the conversation be framed by others in a loaded, perpetuating, and perhaps even negative way? I'm wondering, does the use of the term race itself promote unconscious choices and behaviors?
Well, I think one thing to get clear about the term race is that it's about notions of the body. From colonization, from past history, certain schemes about how we perceive bodies, how we sort bodies into groups, have been created. And whether we want to believe they're there or not, they're there. They create experience and experience associated with bodies. By denying that, we deny that experience. And it's in all of us. We're all racialized.
So, Susanna Rinderly, listening to your 2012 TED Albuquerque talk on YouTube, which I recommend people Google and find, and perhaps we'll have a link up to it, I noted your discussion of biases that we each have, that we come to the table with. Can you speak to biases a bit and tell us, how do learned biases around race affect our choices and behavior?
Sure. This is a really important topic that is getting more attention in the field I work in, the diversity and inclusiveness realm, kind of at a professional level. And bias, I argue that biases aren't bad. Biases are unconscious orientations and tendencies that we have, whether we're conscious of them or not. And I'm finding, and I'm not the only one doing this work, there's other people around the country doing this, that this is a really helpful way to explore and frame the conversation, particularly for white people, people of European American descent, because it tends to take out some of the guilt and shame, anger and blame that Tanya was talking about, and help people get, not that we shouldn't be getting at that and talking about that too, but helping people to realize that the way that our brains work as Homo sapiens is to categorize, like Ricky was talking about. And thinking that we don't do that is really not helping us have the conversation or move us forward. We are constantly and unconsciously categorizing people, things, and experiences to help us order our experience and keep us safe. And this is something that served us as a species for thousands of years.
Well, and I gave you a little example when I met you this morning. I said, my sister's name is Susan. I know your name is Susanna, but I want to say Susan. So you said, oh, yeah, that's the path of least resistance.
The path of least resistance in our brain. So when I'm doing my work in New Mexico, I like to use the examples of our wonderful dirt roads in New Mexico that have been rained on and baked in the sun and rained on and baked again. And when you're driving on these roads, you just kind of naturally fall into the pattern that's been blazed by previous folks and by yourself in the past. And it's hard to get up out of those ruts and drive off into the field because we've been wired to think and categorize things a certain way. But that doesn't mean that they're accurate or functional. And the problem is that the problem is not that we have biases and that we categorize. The problem is that we do it unconsciously and then do behaviors based on those biases that are not effective and are not helpful and can be harmful.
So why is it important to become conscious then of our biases?
Because the more conscious we, and I don't believe, and I'm certainly no brain neuroscience, but based on what I've been hearing and reading, I don't know that it's possible for us to ever become 100% conscious of our biases. But until we become more conscious and own the fact that we have biases, both negative and positive, and that those are playing out in our actions, we will continue to say things and do behaviors that are unconscious, that we're not choosing and we're not thinking through. And this is a bigger topic that we'll be talking about today, but that played out a lot in what happened between Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman.
Okay, Don, you wanted to add something?
And it's basically, it's very difficult to change any habit that you're not conscious of. You have to know what's going on in order to say, oh, you know what, this is something that I need to work on, or this is something I need to change. You have to first bring it to consciousness.
So when Barack Obama was elected, there was talk of us being in a post-racial world. Were any of you under that impression?
No.
So,
neither was any other person of conscience.
No. But there was a certain level of hope, dare I say, you know, perhaps espoused by the campaign. But why were we not in a post-racial world, Ricky?
Mm-hmm.
Would that even be a good thing?
Well, sure. I think it's a good thing to hope for a post-racial world. I mean, race was created for one purpose. That's to oppress. It really serves no other function. It's not biological. It's human created. So sure, being post-racial at some point is good, but we're not there. There's a long ways to go to get there. I think the problem was framing the problem of race around access and opportunity. And that is historical with the civil rights movement. And therefore, then if you focus on the problem of racism is only about access to certain jobs, like being president, then it allows some people to think, well, okay, well, now a person of color is president, so it's over. And that's a very convenient thing for whites who wish to maintain some sense of superiority or privilege or status.
So sort of buried then again. Mm-hmm. But here we are with another opportunity to look mm-hmm. again. Yes, Susanna, you want to
think
say
another
something?
Way of looking at it also is some of the conversations I have with organizations that I serve, especially in the corporate world, where for a long time diversity has been the buzzword. And diversity has been about we want this many of these different looking people in our organization. But what they're not realizing is that diversity is not the end. It should be the means to an end, which is inclusion and equity and power in decision making, which is what gets us brilliance and excellence. Those are the reasons to do it. So when you just are able to see, okay, we've got one of each of these in these different categories. Oh, we've got a president over here that's African American. We've got CEOs over here. Okay, done. But we're not looking at the bigger structural experience of large populations of people, and we're forgetting about the inclusion and equity piece.
You know, interesting, Ricky, when you talk about superiority, it always seems to me that that's sort of what we're talking about here. One's need to feel superior over someone or something. And I, even in the wake of the verdict in the Zimmerman case, and I think Kathy McGill and I were exchanging comments on Facebook, I said, if we could just own up to this need to feel superior, superior, and sort of vow to get rid of even the vestiges of it, we'd be in a better place.
I think that's very important. And one of the things that when you talk about having Barack Obama, does that equal post, you know, a post-racial society? You know, it's wonderful to have him as the president of the United States, but the president doesn't make the laws; Congress does. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Congress, Congress does not look like the makeup of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. So we certainly can't be post-racial when we don't have the a representation that equals the country. And you're right. Superiority has an awful lot to do with things. Unfortunately, in this country, I feel almost more than any other countries, we have always had this thing where we feel like one group has to be superior to the other group. And until we get to the point where more people realize that, are conscious of it, and to begin to work on ways of dismantling it, we're not going to have a more equal society.
And Susanna, you want to add something?
And again, I think that for the majority of white or European American people, that's not conscious. I myself am a white ally with a multiracial identity, and I could probably count on my two hands the number of white people that I've met in the last 10 years that consciously believe in superiority of one group over another.
Consciously.
That's an important piece of our identity as Americans. But it's more the unconscious white privilege that people that are light-skinned and European-American walk around with not even realizing. Most of us have experienced being different from others, but our differences aren't treated equally. Mm-hmm. Some of our differences give us advantages, and some give us disadvantages. And those of us that receive advantages from our color or our various privilege don't even usually realize that it's happening.
Oh, Ricky, you want to add something? This is your area of expertise here.
Yeah. I don't want to confuse consciousness with knowledge.
Okay,
in other words, somebody can have a lot of knowledge about how things work. Like whites, I think, actually have a lot of knowledge about how a system of race works. It would be very hard to do it and perpetuate it without that knowledge. But it's another thing to be conscious of some knowledge that you've repressed in order to continue the process.
Mm-hmm. Right, because it's repressed. Now, back, yes. Tanya, you were talking about Congress. And interestingly, when I was preparing, I found an article on the Huffington Post about three black congressmen speaking out about still being discriminated against. And so there was their story. Mm-hmm. And then I started to read the comments. Mm-hmm. And the comments, you know, they're mixed. Some people feel tremendous empathy and understanding. But some were like, would you just get over this? You know, you're imagining it. You're perpetuating it. Why do people feel that need to belittle instances of
again, I feel like it's sort of back to that consciousness and wanting to fix the problem. If you don't want to fix the problem, and if you are benefiting from there being a problem, then the number one thing to do is to say there is no problem. Therefore, there is nothing that needs to be fixed. There is nothing that needs to be changed. And I can continue to gain from all of the things that I get because there is this problem.
Susanna, you want to add something?
I think there's a tremendous amount of cognitive dissonance in terms of identity. If white people were to really believe what most African Americans are saying, it would severely disrupt the beliefs that we have about our nation and yes. how it works and what the reality is that we're living in. We're living in separate realities. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real, again, in my opinion, unconscious for the most part, resistance to really hearing, believing, and understanding the reality of people of color, particularly African Americans. There was a Gallup poll on Monday. 85% of African Americans in the U.S. think that the Zimmerman verdict was unjust. 54% of whites believed it was fair. That's a tremendous gap yes. in experience and ways that people are perceiving, experiencing, and reading this
All
situation.
Right, absolutely. If you would like to join in our discussion today, there are several ways for you to participate. You may call either 277-5866, that's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number 1-877-899-5866. You can also email comments and questions to callinshow@KUNM.org. When we get back from our short break, we'll be joined by Catherine McGill. But as we leave, here's a question for you. Has the Zimmerman verdict and the renewed discussion of race afforded you an opportunity to examine your own behaviors and circumstances concerning race? Tell us about what you've found. Now we'll take our short break.
Interested in learning more about public health and how to make a difference? The New Mexico Public Health Learning Collaborative is offering public health courses between July and September to provide a better understanding of the role of public health and the power it has to help communities. For more information or to register, visit nmphlc.org. A message from the tax-exempt New Mexico Department of Health, University of New Mexico, and New Mexico State University.
Feast for Peace, a cultural celebration of the Middle East, will be held at the Scottish Rite Center in Santa Fe on Thursday, August 1st at 5:30 p.m. Feast for Peace is an opportunity to enjoy tasty Middle Eastern hors d'oeuvres, music and dance, and meet young women peacemakers from Palestine and Israel. For complete details, visit creativityforpeace.com, a message from the tax-exempt Creativity for Peace.
Good morning and welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo. We're talking about race today, how race consciously and unconsciously affects our behavior and the choices we make. I'm joined in the studio by Susanna Rinderly. She's a consultant, president of Susanna Rinderly Consulting. I'm joined by University of New Mexico Professor Ricky Lee Allen and Tanya Covington, executive director of Peacemakers Consulting. Joining us by phone now is Catherine McGill, the founder and director of the New Mexico Black History Organizing Committee and the director of Roots Summer Academy, a multicultural arts camp. Welcome to the discussion, Kathy.
Good morning, you guys.
Good morning, and I'm sure you all know each other. Mm-hmm. Kathy, I have learned in the wake of the Zimmerman verdict that you are preparing to convene community dialogues around racial issues and that you've already received partial funding for this project. Can you tell us more about this, please?
Yes, we're really pleased to report that we're one of about 450 organizations in the United States that have been selected to be a part of the National Endowment for the Humanities Gilder Lehrman Institute facilitated discussions on race in America. They're calling it Created Equal, America's Civil Rights Struggle. And as I've listened to all of you really fine panelists in the studio talking this morning, I know that the key to making a change in the United States is to have some facilitated discussions about where we are right now, like understanding where we came from. I think it was Patrick Henry that said that I know of no other way to judge the future but by the past. So we have to go back to where we came from and how we got to where we are right now in order to figure out how we do better in the future. So I think that the first step is to have these perhaps uncomfortable conversations about where we are right now and what's really going on. As the kids like to say, let's have some real talk about this. And once we have that real talk, then we have to take it a step further and not just talk about it, but we have to be about it. We have to do those things that we each can do to make a change. And what I am really wanting everyone to understand is that each one of us has a personal responsibility for making the world a better place, and that each one of us can do simple things to affect those changes that we're looking for.
Now, Kathy, I believe you told me that one of your first organized events will probably involve youth. So we talked about this a bit before we got on air, but let's talk about the future. Let's talk about younger generations. What are you seeing, and what do you hope to accomplish in discussing these issues with youth?
As I look at it, as I look in the mirror at my gray hair, my youth is in the rearview mirror right now. But I have benefited from being around a lot of young people. And I think they're, quite frankly, a lot better than we are. But they have been affected by the way the world is right now and seeing what their parents are saying, the polarization that is existing in the United States right now. Our young people are being subjected to that. So it's important for us to hear from them about what they think is going on and how they think they might do a better job than we have done thus far. So youth-led conversations about making a difference in the United States and in the world are critically important to going forward. And I think that they are many times left out of the conversation because we feel like we know better than them, but I disagree.
All right, let's go ahead and take our first caller. Philip has been holding for a while. He's from Taharis. Good morning, Philip. Welcome to our discussion.
Good morning, and thank you for the discussion. The panel mentioned before the unconscious element of racism and white privilege, that people have a position without consciously realizing it. I would like to suggest the panel itself think about perhaps that they are unconscious of racism that they have, and that their reliance on ad hominem attacks rather than rational thinking indicates that they have a prejudice themselves and an elitism and privilege that comes from people with educations who are on the panel and not on the call list on radio programs and who can choose and select their indignation, where we have 300 million individuals in this country, and many of them don't identify themselves by their race. And it is not necessarily evil for them to feel that way. It may even be liberating.
All right. And Philip, thank you. Thank you for calling today. Anyone on the panel want to address? Yeah, Ricky, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think these are just made up positions. One thing we didn't talk about in the beginning is the actual material aspects of race. And there's a lot of things that have happened that are objective, that have data behind it. We just know that being white, for example, provides a material advantage. There's been things that have happened historically, and we're not just talking about slavery. There's a lot that's happened since then. For example, in the 20th century with housing and banking, where during the Depression, when FDR and the whole new idea of mortgage insurance, government-backed, when the government put out guidelines for who could then get the better loans, because it changed. You could then get a house for 20% down. Before that was 50% down. But the government wouldn't back just any mortgages that were given. The government put out guidelines that said, okay, you can give loans to people, but not to the following groups. And people of color were always listed there. Some years they'd throw in a white group. But essentially that created, from the 1930s up to the 70s, that built the American suburbs. So essentially the American suburbs were subsidized by the government for white people. And that created wealth. Most people's wealth is in their house, to the point where the recent data from the Pew Institute said that the average white family now has 20 times the wealth of the average black family, 18 times the wealth of the average Latino family.
And it's a legacy wealth. It's a wealth that's passed down.
Passed down, and is still being created by current practices and laws.
Okay, exactly. Susanna, you wanted to add something. Thank you again, Philip, for your call.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure what Philip is hearing in terms of attacks. I think in terms of bias, I can only speak for myself, but I'm definitely a recovering racist. And I work very hard on being conscious of my privilege and my biases. I think that's part of integrity in doing this type of work. And in terms of, you know, hearing words like evil and attack, I'm not sure where that's coming from. I'm curious about that. But in terms of talking about the 300 million people in the United States believing that they're individuals, I think I would encourage Philip to be curious about that and to talk with other people, especially people of color, and feel and ask them if they feel like they are treated like individuals. Because in my experience personally and in research I've read, the problem is that people of color want to be treated like individuals, and they're not.
You know, and I remember now, curious was one of your five C's from your TED Talk. And again, I want to encourage people to Google that and look at that on YouTube. So let's just get something clear, too. This is not just a black and white issue. Mm-hmm. We're talking all gradations of color, things that make anyone different from anyone else. Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in another caller. It's Frank from Albuquerque. Good morning, Frank, and thank you for calling.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
I'd like to thank you for having the show. And okay, so I want to ask the panel to comment on the situation of institutional bias or institutional racism. And number one, in the Florida incident, the jury was actually instructed in the Stand Your Ground law. Okay, so I think that's really an example of institutional racism. And here in New Mexico and across the country, we have segregated special education classrooms. And though we do have the 1997 IDEA Act that was supposed to undo the segregated special education classrooms, and I think that, too, is an example of institutional racism, because really bigotry or race or racism or bias directed at people with disabilities is also a form of racism. So if you could just comment on those two things, I'd really appreciate it.
All right.
Thank
who'd like to take that? Ricky? Okay. Go right ahead.
Sure. You know, our social institutions were created as a constitutive part of society. So, you know, anything that we see societally should be going on in the institutions as well. I'm in education. And one of the main mechanisms through which schooling as a system recreates racial hierarchies, racial divisions, is through something called tracking. You know, tracking had always existed in some form, but post Brown, post civil rights, when schools were, you know, allegedly desegregated, that the racial segregation was recreated within the school itself through racialized notions about smartness, intelligence, academic ability. So what we see in a lot of schools is, yeah, there may be people of different races in the schools, although schools are more segregated now than they were 50 years ago. We've really backtracked from that. But if you go in the school, you'll see in the AP class, you know, often you'll see whites, maybe some Asians, maybe some from other groups. But if you look at the lower track classes, the class where it's assumed that these are low-ability students or students in need of remediation, it's mostly people of color. Or if there's whites, they're mostly from poor or working-class backgrounds. And then it's rationalized as well. They just need more attention. These are really remedial programs, and we'll lift them up through more focus on skills. The problem, though, is that it starts young. It starts right after kindergarten, usually, and it just gets worse and worse. The lower tracks get bigger, or in high school, they're the ones who are dropping out, or I would say getting pushed out of school. And the gap between those who get placed in the higher tracks and low tracks just get wider and wider as they go through their schooling.
All right, Frank, thanks for your call. And we've got other panelists who want to comment. Okay. Go ahead, Tanya.
I think one of the things also that people don't understand, as Ricky said, that this kind of institutionalized racism really is put into, is recreated and put into all of our institutions. And it's interesting in talking about education, because that's one of the ones where I feel like it shows up most. There's been a number of discussions recently on the around the anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education about how good that decision actually was for people of color. And one of the things that I think an awful lot of people, and I know it upsets an awful lot of people to hear that there are a number of us, myself included, that think that that wasn't one of the best things that ever happened to us, not because separate but equal, is not important, but because of how it was carried out within a system of institutionalized racism. What people don't understand is that when we had segregated schools, although they certainly were not equal, one of the good things about that was, at least in the black community, having segregated schools meant that we had black teachers. Black mm-hmm. teachers had high expectations mm-hmm. for black students. When the schools supposedly, as Ricky said, became desegregated, the first thing that happened was all of those black teachers lost their jobs. And so black students were then put into a system that already thought that they were inferior. And the teachers who taught black students thought they were inferior and treated them accordingly. And children, like everyone else, always adhere to the expectations put on them. So if you think that someone is stupid and you tell them that or treat them that way long enough, they will tend to act that way. And so then they end up getting tracked, and it continues and continues and continues.
Susanna, you wanted to add something?
One concept I want to add to what my colleagues have said is that intent does not equal impact.
Absolutely.
And that shows up one-to-one in interpersonal interactions, but it shows up dramatically when we talk about institutionalized bias and racism. Again, in my experience working within and with organizations, for the vast majority have good intentions. But when you have good intentions and you apply one rule or one standard to groups of people and individuals who are vastly different in terms of their starting point, in terms of their resources, in terms of their access, you end up having disparities in the impact. And we need to move away from justifying what we're doing because we have good intentions and looking at how our impact is disadvantaging certain groups more than others and having an unequal effect on them.
And that's exactly, Tanya, what you're talking about in terms of Brown versus Board of Ed.
Absolutely.
Ricky, you want to add something? Then Kathy, I want to get to you too. Go ahead, Ricky.
It may sound as like blasphemy from an education professor, but sometimes we almost put too much on education, at least the system of education, to solve things like economic inequality that's been racialized. And part of that is an ahistorical understanding. The wealth I was talking about that whites have didn't come solely from them having better education. It came from racist policies, racist banking practices, racist real estate practices and policy. To then come along to the civil rights movement and say, okay, well, you know, we're not going to redistribute any of that. We're just going to give you the opportunity to prove that you deserve it by going to school, and then maybe if you make it through school, then maybe you'll get the rewards. But we're not just going to give that to you, even though it was just basically given to whites before that.
Yeah. Kathy McGill, would you like to add anything to this particular aspect?
Yes, thank you. I thought about the first caller, Philip, and what I really felt like when I heard him speak was that he's really just talking about his emotion, how I feel, and that's the way many of us are trying to navigate these murky waters of race and where we are in America. So he expressed the way he feels and the fact that we got asked to be on the radio show and perhaps some other people who might have wanted to express their opinions didn't. And I think that, you know, there are these divisions all over the place, and it comes down to how do I feel? And figuring out how to unpack those feelings and do something about them is what we have to get to. Because I think even in our conversation today that we're sort of talking about what happened before or why we got to the place that we're at right now, but I really want us to get to a conversation about what do we do about it? How do we affect the changes that we believe need to be made? How do we figure out how to peacefully coexist when we have all of these polarizing studies that get presented about, you know, let's just say the Trayvon Martin case, where 54% of white Americans think that it was a fair and just verdict, and 85% of African Americans think that it was unjust, and I'm sure there are other populations who were not polled who, you know, have polarizing thoughts about that verdict as well. So if we talk about the fact that we want to be all one, we want to be the human race, how do we start to develop our discussions so that we can get to solutions that are based on being one? And right now I think that our conversations are polarizing and we're not really focused on solutions.
All right, Kathy, and we're going to go to a short break. When we get back, we'll be taking some more calls. How do racial biases affect you in your daily life? How, in the words of Kathy McGill, do you navigate these murky waters of race? We'll be back with you in a moment.
Hello, people. I'm Mark Maron. On the next WTF, I talked to the actor Bryan Cranston about the role that changed his life, Walter White, on Breaking Bad.
The hardest work that an actor has ever done is on poorly written material. The easiest work that we do is on when it's good and it seeps into your psyche and your soul.
Plus, Jon Hamm from Mad Men. That's on the next WTF from PRX.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, if gun violence touched your life, or you just heard about it, how would you make peace with it?
The killer stalked Sandy Hook Elementary School, taking innocent lives that had barely begun.
And I just started thinking about something to do about it. How is there some way to do something with this grief and with this heavy heart and this sadness?
Three stories of responding to gun violence next time on Peace Talks Radio.
Friday morning at 8 on 89.9 KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo. We're talking about race today with our panelists. And you can certainly join us. You can call 277-5866 locally, 1-877-899-5866 long distance. You can also post your comments at callinshow@kunm.org. Let's get to a caller now. Let's get to Nelson, who's been holding patiently. Nelson from Albuquerque, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having this conversation.
Absolutely.
I actually was touched by something Philip said. He mentioned that we're a nation of 300 million individuals, and I think that racism is a form of collectivist thinking, and it's something that's very difficult to discuss without actually engaging in further collectivist thinking. I mean, even just to brand someone or a certain situation a racist or as a you know, this is a racial situation is overlooking so many other aspects of it. And I think that oftentimes the discussion of racism tends to promote that collectivist thinking. And my kind of hard question for you guys is what do you think the effect of President Obama's comments, not once but twice, about the Trayvon Martin case had? And that's the hard question for you. The easy question I also wanted to bring up was about institutional racism and the effects that the war on drugs has. And can you really have a discussion about improving racial tension and racism in this nation without discussing ending the war on drugs?
All right, let's go ahead and thank you so much for your call. And Tanya, let's start with you this time.
Okay. It's interesting. I'll start with the last thing first. It was talking about the war on drugs because April 7th, there is going to be the showing of a film called, I believe it's called The House in Which I Live. And the tagline for it is that the war on drugs was never about drugs. And that's certainly true. And I think that that's... it's interesting to me when you're talking about collectivist thinking and also about institutionalized racism, because I feel like racism is in every institution, and one of the ways, and there are certain very divisive ways in which racism gets used to keep people of color down, and the war on drugs was most certainly one of them. And I feel like until we begin to talk about solutions and come up with solutions to not only end the war on drugs, but also to look at what's going on with the prison industrial complex, we're not going to be able to solve racism. Because in order to solve any big problem, you have to take down the bricks that keep that in line. And these are a number of sort of the bricks that keep that wall up. As for Obama's comments on race and on the Trayvon Martin case, I thought they were very good. I was very happy to hear them say that. And I feel like for an awful lot of people, I'm sure it was surprising and shocking to hear the president of the United States identify with Trayvon Martin and talk about being the victim of racism. But I feel like to all of those people who have bought into that because we have a black president, there is a post-racial society, they needed to hear that. They needed to hear that that he really could have been Trayvon Martin, and that as a father, he is concerned about what will happen to black children. I thought it was wonderful. I was glad that he spoke out about it. And as for the collectivist thinking, I feel like, you know, yes, there's always that sort of thing. One of the things that racism does is makes people go into collectivist thinking, and when people think about people of color, they don't think about us as, you know, the individuals that Philip was talking about. They think about us as a group and assign a certain characteristics to us. And so I feel like we need to talk about that, and again talk about ways of undoing that.
You know, I had a very specific instance of that growing up. My father, when he would talk about people of color as a group, had one way of talking about that. But then when he talked about an individual whom he knew, it was very different. And mm-hmm. that was keenly in my mind. We're going to go mm-hmm. to our next caller. We've got him stacked up. Let's mm-hmm. go ahead and bring in Christy. Christy, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for your show. I think it's really important. I just wanted to make a couple comments and then ask some questions. When I was growing up, and I grew up as a white person in the Midwest in Indiana, and my family didn't talk about race. There wasn't any kind of dialogue about race in our family. And around the table, we had other topics that were more important. And I think the conversation probably looks a lot different for people of color around the table. And one thing that I think might be important to share is what are some tools that white people can use to step up to help be allies for people of color? And also, my other question is, I hear people say, oh, I treat all people the same. I'm colorblind. I don't see race. And I think they're saying that in an attempt to be non-racist. And I'd like to hear your comments about that, please.
All right. Thanks so much, Christy. Susanna, you go first here. Just...
Sure. Thank you, Christy, for your comments and your questions. So I'll talk about the colorblindness first. I agree with you that in my experience, the colorblind comment is an attempt to kind of like what we were talking about earlier to say, I don't see that, I see you. And what most people of color have told me is that I want to be seen as a person and my color. I am a complete human being that takes all of these different things into consideration. And so, and there's actually been a couple really interesting articles written lately about how it's not about color blindness. The problem is color muteness, that we are not talking about race. And the fact, and saying that we don't see it is empirically not accurate from a brain perspective. We do see it. The question is, rather, what do we do with that information? And when we have that information, do we do justice? And of doing justice and being an ally, there are several different actions that you can take. I list some on my latest blog post on my website, but just to summarize some of the things that we've said already today, have the conversation, listen to what other people are saying, believe that what they're saying is true and their experience, examine and constantly be vigilant to your own unconscious biases. And I think a big piece is to develop emotional intelligence and develop internal abilities to have the courage and the resilience to constantly be looking at this in ourselves and to face the fact that we may be unconsciously contributing to something that's not in alignment with our values and find ways to do different behaviors and become more conscious of where that's coming from.
All right, Ricky, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, there's a couple of issues, and for actually both the callers that just called, you know, the problem is that there is a white collectivism that needs to be named. And one of the problems that we as whites often do is we prevent people of color from naming reality, from actually telling us what is real. And one of the ways we sort of, you know, push often as white people push back against that is with color blindness, but I would say it's an ideology, a colorblind ideology. And one of the hallmarks of it is that is to, for example, one of the main pieces of it is to claim some sort of racial egalitarianism. Well, sure, we all ought to live together. We all ought to intermarry. We all ought to go to school together. To sort of profess those things and like, oh, it shouldn't matter your race and we're just individuals and so on and so on. But then we don't act that way. You know, we don't actually go to school with people of color. We don't choose to live in neighborhoods with people of color. Usually we do the opposite. Or we have like terms like diversity. Well, you know, like what does diversity mean? You know, what percentage or what groups constitute a good form of diversity for whites? Usually it's not much. and there are some groups we seem to like a little better than others. And we see that in schools. You know, white flight in schools varies depending on who the groups of color are. Like whites will tolerate more Asians than they will blacks. Mm-hmm. But still, for both groups, there's a certain tipping point where whites will, you know, run the other way. One thing I would ask whites, so one is to, for we whites to look at our history. You know, what have we done in the past? What are we doing currently in terms of policy practice? But the other thing, and this goes back to these dialogues and conversations, is why do we get so emotional talking about race? Where does that emotion come from? I mean, there's a lot of things in the world where maybe we don't understand someone or we don't, you know, have knowledge of something. We don't get emotional about it. I mean, I used to teach physical science as a, you know, middle school teacher. And I taught all sorts of things like Bernoulli's principle and condensation. Students didn't get upset about that when they found out they had a different idea than what was true.
Right.
But with race, for some reason, there's all this emotion around that. And especially with whites.
Well, let me go ahead and ask Kathy McGill a question. So, Kathy, let's say that you and I knew each other outside of this situation, and we hadn't had a conversation that was particularly about race. Is that a conversation you would want to have with me, and would you want me to go ahead and initiate it? I mean, I'm trying to understand.
You know, I don't want people to initiate conversations like, well, hey, there's a black woman. I'm going to go ask her about, you know.
Yes.
Like, please don't make me responsible for having to have that conversation on a regular basis. It's not just my responsibility. What I said from the beginning, and I stand by, is that it's each one of our personal responsibilities to figure out where we are. Sandra and Matthew Blakely wrote a book called The Body Has a Mind of Its Own and talked about a young kitten in its infancy, if you don't put it down to interact with its environment, will be functionally blind for the rest of its life because it will never be able to, figure out objects, shapes, or colors based on that lack of interaction in the environment. So what I'm saying is, you know what, why don't you, instead of saying, well, can we go talk about race, I like to go listen to music, you know, ask me what kind of music I like. I love jazz, I love blues, and say, hey, I'm going to a concert on Wednesday. Would you like to come? And I'd say, well, yes, I'd love to come. And perhaps getting to know me as a person would give people the opportunity to understand that we share more things in common than are different. And I think the lack of interaction is what promotes racism in the United States. They really don't know me like that, as the kids might say. Mm-hmm. So understand who I am.
Yep. Okay, let's go ahead and take our next call. It's Jim from Albuquerque. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. I'm really grateful for the dialogue. Very soon after Trayvon Martin was killed, I heard a mother speaking about her two grown boys, and she was saying that from a very early age, since her boys were very young, she knew that it was her job, her responsibility to teach them about racism, because one day they would be black men. And, you know, she actually told them, one day you are going to be discriminated against by a police officer because you're a black man. And it struck me, and you know, it hit home, because I have a son who's African American, and he's 5 now, and I'm not from the black community, I'm not from black culture, and I suddenly thought I might be totally ill-equipped in preparing my son for adulthood, for manhood. And I just wanted to know if your panel of guests had an opinion on how we should be talking to our kids about race, and you know, is this something that we need to do for our young black kids? Do we need to be preparing them still? And basically, that's it.
All right, Jim, thanks so much for your call today. Tanya, you wanted to go ahead and reach
Jim, out? Absolutely, you need to be talking to your son, especially because he's a son and of partial African-American descent. I'm of the notion that parents with kids of color who don't have that conversation, that it constitutes child abuse. Because whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not, your child is going to be discriminated against, especially if they live in this country. If you have not prepared them for that, if you have not talked to them about that, then you are doing a disservice to them. If you don't know how to do that, find someone who does and have them talk to your child. To me, that not doing it is the same as, you know, putting an unarmed child and pushing them out there and say, okay, I'm going to send you to Afghanistan now, and, you know, best of luck. You know you're sending them into a war zone. And if you are a person of color in this United States, you are living in a war zone. You need to know that, and you need to be prepared for it.
And Ricky, just a brief comment from you before we get to our next caller.
Yeah, I would say, and also for whites, we need to flip that question. What if, I mean, your kid could have been George Zimmerman, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Your kid could be Juror B-37. Mm-hmm. Your kid could be the white teachers we have in urban schools. I mean, what are white parents doing from the beginning to teach their kids about what it means to be a white person in the world, and to help them figure out how to unravel that and to stop it?
Yeah, good point. Look at both sides of the equation there. Clifton, you've been holding patiently, and I wonder if you have a brief comment or question you'd like to make. Thank you for joining us.
Appreciate it. I'll try to be as brief as possible. I went to Albuquerque High School. And I'm a white guy. My mom married a Spanish guy. I went by the name Gonzalez. We had a lot of northern New Mexico Hispanic culture in the house. And it created a lot of confusion in my life and for those around me in some respects, because, you know, a lot of times my white friends would make some of those unconscious remarks, and I would take them personally, and they wouldn't understand why. It was kind of strange. But the other thing that I really wanted to point out was that in 1978 at Albuquerque High, we had Indians, blacks, Hispanics, whites, Asians, and I was fairly involved in school, and I remember working very effectively with a lot of these people in student council and those kinds of things. So my final point is that I think you can't talk race without talking culture, because sometimes people you know, we have black Hispanics. We have...
Okay, Clifton, I'm going to have to cut you off. I apologize, but let's leave that for another topic. I hope we're not done here with this discussion. I want to thank our guests, UNM Professor Ricky Lee Allen, consultant Susan Rinderlee, the founder and director of New Mexico Black History Organizing Committee, Catherine McGill, and Tanya Covington, executive director of Peacemakers Consulting, for making themselves available to our listeners. Thank you all. Thanks to our callers for helping to develop our discussion today. My apologies to those we did not get to. Thanks to our engineer, Marshall Broyles, assisted by Roman Garcia, our assistant producer and call screener, Andy Lyman, Michael Hess. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on KUNM, news and music that connect from the University of New Mexico.